giggle, giggle. That's neat.
Yeah.
Well, you know what, Bobby? The only reason you cut your hair is because I did first, and it looks really cool. And you, you're just a dirty vegan.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. I'm a vegan. You guys, you guys put the meat in your mouth.
No, no,
because
no.
I don't.
So there's a reason, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's fine. You wear sunglasses indoors.
I do. You know why?
Yeah.
Not
you blind?
No, I'm not blind. You know what the other reason is?
No. You're not cool. You're an asshole.
Welcome to episode 270 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com for Sunday, April 21st, 2013. I am the Sala Monster, and this podcast cannot come any quicker after this really shitty week, is the best way I could put it. What a horrible week this was. A lot of death and mayhem and carnage and just bad stuff going on. Started on Monday with the bombings at the Boston Marathon. People losing their lives, losing limbs, just a horrific experience. Later in the week, there was a massive explosion at a fertilizer plant down in Texas, at least 14 people dead. They're still searching through the rubble for bodies down there. Even up to the Elvis impersonator that they arrested on charges of sending letters laced with ricin to the president and another senator. Just so many crazy people out there and just crazy things going on this week. And it's nice to have pro wrestling, quite frankly, to take your mind off things. That's actually the subject of the Layfield Report column I did up on JBL's website this week, layfieldreport.com. It really is just a look at how pro wrestling is such a great form of escapism when it comes to tragic real-life events like this. A lot of bad stuff happens. You know, the world can be a real scary place. And not unlike movies or other TV shows, you know, wrestling is a way to escape and to get away from it all. It's a form of entertainment that, in a way, it's kind of weird because you have all this bloodshed and violence going on around you, and yet you're filling it with a form of entertainment that is largely based on the illusion of violence and bloodshed, although, you know, not so much blood anymore, but you get the point. It's kind of a weird thing. You know, it's violence, but not really. So anyway, that's the nature of the column this week. Check it out, layfieldreport.com. Now, this is not to say that I'm going to go easy on these shows this week. There was a lot of bad shit on Raw and Impact this week. Not my favorite editions of either show. And we're going to go through the key elements of both. We're also going to have a review of the Bret Hitman Hart Dungeon Collection DVD that just recently came out. I mentioned that before. Those of you maybe who are on the fence about it, maybe don't even know that this DVD is out there. We'll have a full review of that coming up a little bit later on. First, want to get through a couple of news items here. Earlier this morning, The Rock actually sent out a very interesting tweet. Now, The Rock has been tweeting about his injuries. Remember after WrestleMania, news came out that he suffered some severe abdominal injuries, he suffered a hernia, he injured the abductor muscle in his hip, just really messed himself up in that match with John Cena at WrestleMania, and indicated that he would not be undergoing surgery. He had spoken with his doctor, the doctor had said that he could just rehab it, it would heal on its own, it would scar up on its own. Well, The Rock tweeted this morning, "Saw my doctor who had to push my intestines back through the tear in my abdomen. Surgery is next week." So it looks like The Rock, in fact, will be having surgery. I don't know what the surgery entails. He didn't give any details. I don't know how long that means he'll be on the sidelines for, even in terms of doing movies. He's supposed to be in the middle of preparing for filming Hercules in the next 4 or 5 weeks, I believe, is when filming at least was supposed to start. I don't know if that pushes things back. And the bigger question, again, is how does this impact his wrestling career going forward? I mean, it was in doubt before. Even without the surgery, would The Rock want to come back and wrestle again, given how injury-prone he seems to be? I mean, he came back last year in the match with Cena at WrestleMania, and you could argue maybe it was John Cena's fault, you know, coming off the top rope with that move. With, you know, was he being reckless with it? Was it really his fault, The Rock's fault? Whoever's fault it was, The Rock claimed to have torn his hamstring off the bone in that match. And now, of course, he comes out of this match at WrestleMania. You would think the guy was in literally the middle of a war. I mean, he tore his abdominals open, he tore this, he tore that. Fact is, Rock doesn't have to wrestle if he doesn't want to. He's getting older, he's going to be turning, I think he turns 42 this year, 41 or 42. There's been talk of him and Brock Lesnar at next year's WrestleMania. I feel like if you got Brock Lesnar in the ring throwing somebody like The Rock around, especially as big and jacked up as he is, I don't know if that's such a good idea either. We'll see what happens. It's going to be very, very interesting to see what comments The Rock makes about it. I don't know what the lines of communication have been like between him and WWE. I don't even know if he tipped off WWE that he was going to be having surgery or if he just tweeted it and they're just going to read it on Twitter like everybody else. Apparently, there was a communications breakdown between the two of them the night after WrestleMania. There was a lot of drama going on, a lot of people pissed off at The Rock for just up and leaving without even letting them know, and they had to scramble and rewrite the show. There may be some bad blood there. One would think there probably is. I would say that Rock's wrestling future is probably suspect at best, but hopefully surgery goes well. And, yeah, Rock's new movie is actually out in about 2 weeks. Actually, I think The Rock's new movie is out at the end of this upcoming week. I think it's the Pain and Gain movie comes out this Friday, so he may not be able to do much in the way of promotion for that movie. WWE made a major announcement this week, which should not be all that much of a surprise. If you read my Layfield Report column recently, or if you listen to this show, I've talked about it on the show here before. They officially announced on Thursday the creation of their Performance Center down in Winter Park, Florida. I was kind of hoping maybe they would call it NXT University or something, but apparently it's the WWE Performance Center. It's a training center that will replace their current territory in Tampa, and it will feature 7 different rings. Now, that is contrary to some other wrestling websites I noticed who have been erroneously reporting 5 rings and not 7. Of course, I mentioned 7 rings right here on the Sound Off, you will recall, after we spoke with Dr. Michael Sampson of WWE down at Fan Access in New Jersey. He was the one who mentioned to us 7 rings, not 5. So there's going to be a lot more rings for people to do training in simultaneously. A lot of training going on, obviously. That's kind of the whole point. Not just wrestling training, but also physical fitness, nutrition. I think they'll have some classes when it comes to that sort of thing. They're going to be bringing on staff. I believe a staff of about 16 people, coaches and whatnot, to help the talent in terms of their training. And they're also going to be using this performance center to groom future production talent as well, because WWE has a very good working relationship with with Full Sail University, which is a school located in Winter Park. In fact, Full Sail University, which is where they've been taping a lot of the NXT shows, is directly across, apparently, from wherever this performance center facility is going to be. As far as when it opens, I don't know that they made that official announcement, but again, in speaking with Dr. Sampson a few weeks ago, I mentioned here on the Sound Off, he had mentioned June as an opening date. So if, in fact, it opens in June, you heard it here first. The reason that Full Sail, by the way, and they're talking about grooming production talent as well at this facility, that's really the bread and butter of Full Sail University. There's a lot of people who go there to study television production and that sort of thing, and so they're hoping to develop future production talent from the university. So they're really building this system, and they're really investing a lot in this system. It's actually really cool to see because, as I've said before, for the first time in years, it seems like WWE and Triple H in particular is taking developmental seriously, and you have to. You have to groom new talent, and it's about damn time that they got their act together and shaped up and did something like this and put a little bit of extra money, you know, in the developmental budget. I don't see their spreadsheets. I don't know how much money they devote to developmental each year, but I think it's safe to say that they really haven't placed this level of attention on it in a long-ass time. And one other interesting comment that Triple H made was that he would like to open additional training facilities, but Orlando will continue to be the home base for their developmental training going forward. I think that's another fantastic idea. And one thing I think I've talked about in the past, and this may not be so much about the training centers itself, but more so almost like a little developmental territory, kind of like what NXT is down in Florida. I think they should open up ones in Canada and the UK, and particularly Canada. Obviously, they've had a lot of very talented people from Canada working for WWE, talent that has either trained in Canada, lives in Canada, born there, whatever the case may be. It seems like a pretty fertile pool of talent up there. I don't know why you wouldn't open up a developmental facility up there. And also, remember, Lance Storm has a wrestling school up there, the Storm Wrestling Academy. They actually brought Lance Storm in recently down to Florida to kind of be a guest trainer for a day. He's very well regarded by the company down there. And a lot of people that have trained at Lance Storm School have gone on to be signed by WWE. Just a thought. You know, it might be worth their while to talk to Lance Storm and maybe use his Storm Wrestling Academy as some sort of training center or training ground or developmental territory, for lack of a better term. You know, you already have something set up there. Why start from scratch? But to me, you know, in talking international, Canada and the UK, it would seem to make sense to me to set something up in those regions. I know it requires more money. You've got to hire staff or send staff over there to work. but I think it would be worth it. And also in this country as well. I'm not just saying keep it limited to Florida. You know, I think having one on the East Coast and having one on the West Coast, maybe somewhere in California, would make sense as well. I think it's worth the investment. You can't overinvest in your future. And to me, it seems like they've, if anything, they've been underinvesting for the longest time now. And Triple H seems to have his head on straight, and I give him a lot of credit for what he's doing, but I think they could do an even better job in terms of developmental. Let's talk about Monday Night Raw from this past Monday night in Greenville, South Carolina. Flair Country is the Carolinas. And boy, this was quite the different crowd than what we had seen the week before at the Izod Center. And I don't think anybody really thought the crowd would quite be as lively as it was. We've talked about why the crowd was probably like that. There was a European influence, a lot of fans from countries like the UK and Ireland and other places who had come in for WrestleMania, stayed for Raw the next night. They were really the ones who started many of those chants that caught fire in the building that night. I was there. I saw it myself. And a lot of those fans went home, and they weren't in Greenville for Raw Monday night. And, you know, you can't have a crowd like that every single week. At the same time, boy, was it noticeable, and boy, did it drag this show down to the depths of hell. This was overall, a very boring, in my opinion, edition of Monday Night Raw. There were some noteworthy things that happened on the show, but it just felt so flat coming off that show the week before. Now, they're going to be back in the UK. They're overseas now on tour. They're taping at least this week's Raw, possibly next week's as well. I know this Monday is in London. I don't know where Raw the following week is, if it'll also be in London, if it'll be in Manchester. I would imagine the crowd will be a lot livelier and more active. They don't go to the UK all the time, and then coming off this, you know, fandangoing craze and all this stuff that came out of WrestleMania, my guess is that the crowd and perhaps the quality of the show overall is going to be much improved this week. I certainly hope so, because this show just fell completely flat this week. Now, one of the major things on the show, the Ryback heel turn. A lot of us who were there at the Izod Center the week before and saw Ryback attack John Cena, it didn't exactly come off as a heel turn. You know, when I first saw it, my first thought was, okay, Ryback wants a title shot, John Cena is the champion, so he took out John Cena. I didn't really look at it and go, holy shit, Ryback just turned heel. But this week on Raw, they pretty much solidified that it in fact was a heel turn. They had Ryback cut this 5-minute long pre-taped backstage promo, which I actually thought was very, very good, and it was very, very smart on WWE's part not to have Ryback do that same promo in the ring for a whole variety of reasons. Number one, there's ain't no way Ryback was going to be able to memorize all that shit. That's number one. Number two, I'd like to see more promos like this. We used to see this more back in the day where it's not just a backstage promo, but you cut the crowd out. I don't remember hearing the crowd in this promo. It's just a guy backstage looking directly into the camera, cutting a promo. You don't hear chants in the background, people going, what? People buzzing. You know, one of the things that really annoys me that Kevin Dunn just, it drives me up a fucking wall, is when they're showing a backstage segment and they pan out to the live crowd. Like, they want to show people looking up at a giant screen. The problem is, most of the time when they do this, and this happened on Monday night and it's just comical to me, instead of showing people looking intently up at the video screen, you see people laughing, they're talking amongst themselves, they're not paying any goddamn attention at all to what's being shown up on the TitanTron. What is the point of doing those cutaways? It's just one of those little production things that drives me insane. It's so dumb. But I like to see more promos like this because we don't get enough of these. You know, and you should cut the crowd out. And it's okay to do promos that are not in the ring in front of the crowd because the crowd would have crapped all over this. I guarantee you, this crowd would have been dead as a doornail. You would have had people chanting, boring, Goldberg, what? It just completely messes up people's train of thought. Ryback does not need people messing up his train of thought. He's the last person in the world who needs that right now. So I actually like that aspect of this a lot. It was kind of similar to the Aces and Eights stuff in TNA in that they had that one episode of Impact where Bully Ray laid out their whole plan over 9 months, how it went from start to finish. This is what happened. Let me take you back here. This is why this happened. This is why that happened. They had a pretty good story here where Ryback said, listen, you know, John Cena got attacked a whole bunch of times by the Shield, and each one of those times, I was there to save him. I was there to watch his back. And in the 6 times that the Shield kicked my ass and gave me the triple team powerbomb, John Cena never once helped me out. They even showed footage of the finish from the six-man back at Elimination Chamber when Roman Reigns speared Ryback. Ryback had Seth Rollins up. He speared him. Rollins fell down on top of Ryback, got the pin, which was shocking to me at the time. And in the background, you see John Cena. John Cena's in the ring, and he could have easily broken up the pin, and he kind of tried to, but he didn't. It really did make Cena come off as a bit of a prick, that Ryback had a point. You know, you can almost sympathize with what Ryback is saying, which I'm not sure if that's the effect they were going for. But I like that little touch, that they took the time to actually draw up a backstory. They showed us footage of all these different times that Cena could have saved Ryback, but didn't. I like that aspect of it. As far as whether or not this is going to work, I don't know. It seems that Ryback has a new catchphrase. He kept saying Ryback rules. I don't know if that's like Raven's rules or what the hell that means. I don't know if that means the Feed Me More chant now is done. The Feed Me More chant, it's kind of like the Fandango theme song. That's what the Feed Me More chant has in common with Fandango's theme music. The chant and the song are both more over than the person that it's for. So the Fandango theme music, in my opinion, the Fandangoing, right, everybody going nuts, acting like a moron, it has more to do with the music. Believe me, Fandango himself is not as over as WWE would have you believe. And the Feed Me More chant was the most over part of Ryback's act. You know, Ryback would be in front of some crowds and get a nice reaction, but, you know, there were weeks where the crowd was pretty much dead for Ryback. They didn't really seem to care much, but boy, when he did that Feed Me More thing, they got into that. So I don't know if he's dumped that now. If he's turned heel, I would think that he would dump it, because you don't want people, you know, you don't want something like that that people could get into and start cheering you for. That's not what you do with a heel. So be interesting to see if the Feed Me More stuff goes away. And that's your main event for the Extreme Rules pay-per-view WWE Championship. I should say your co-main event. We'll talk about the other one in a second. John Cena against Ryback. This is the big feud now that they're building up for the next pay-per-view. I don't get it either. You know, Mark Henry, he beat Ryback at WrestleMania. If anything, it should be a triple threat match. And let me just say, I have no interest in seeing a triple threat with John Cena, Ryback, and Mark Henry. It seems like Mark Henry has moved on now to a feud with Sheamus. Fine. But I'm just saying, I still don't understand why Ryback lost at WrestleMania. You could have done the same story at some point with Ryback attacking Cena. You didn't save me all those times with the Shield. But at WrestleMania, why did Mark Henry just fall on top of Ryback and pin him if the idea was that Mark Henry was then going to just go on to feud with Sheamus and Ryback was going to be the one getting a title shot? You know, it's not even like John Cena beat Mark Henry clean as a sheet on Raw last week. I mean, Mark Henry got counted out. Big deal. Mark Henry has a case that he deserves a title shot every bit as much as Ryback does. So that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me. They had Brock Lesnar on the show. He did a segment with 3MB. This was my favorite thing on the entire show. 3MB was out there. They were going to call out The Shield because The Shield had kicked their ass the previous week. And instead, Brock Lesnar's music hit, and everybody got excited, and everybody knew that death was coming. And so Brock goes to the ring. He absolutely destroys 3MB. There was a great spot where Heath Slater was about to go back into the ring after being thrown out by Lesnar, and instead he thought better of it. He jumped down from the apron, he was going to walk around the ring, and all of a sudden Brock Lesnar went from being inside the ring to being outside the ring in the span of about a second and a half, and he took Slater's head off with a clothesline. At first I thought to myself, where the fuck did this guy come from? Are there two Brock Lesnars? Because if there's two Brock Lesnars, that's the scariest thing I've ever heard of. God, is that guy fast. Lesnar was always very quick for a big guy. His agility, his speed, it's just phenomenal. And Lesnar picked up Slater outside and gave him two F5s on the barricade, which was padded, so he's fine. But it looked really cool. In fact, the fans were so into this, they kept chanting one more time. And Brock smiled, and it looked like he was about to give the fans what they wanted, and Paul Heyman talked him out of it. So believe me, at some point, when and if the day comes that they want to turn Brock Lesnar babyface, and they will, it won't be very difficult for them to do so, but I'm happy they're keeping him heel for now. And so he gets in the ring, Paul Heyman basically cuts the promo for him, challenging Triple H to a rubber match in their feud, as if we needed to see a third match between two guys who don't work well together. But they're doing the third match at Extreme Rules, and it's going to be inside a steel cage. And Paul Heyman did a phenomenal job here of making this steel cage match sound like the end-all, be-all, biggest match of all time, which is not an easy thing to do because steel cage matches by today's standards are no big thing. We see them fairly frequently. They don't make a big deal about them. You know, steel cage matches traditionally were used for what they're using it for here. You would use a cage match as the culmination of a feud between two guys, you know, like a blood feud. And that's exactly what they're using this match for. This will hopefully be the third and final match between these two guys to cap off their feud. If they have any sense about them at all, Brock Lesnar will go over, and that will be the end of their feud. And I like that idea. I like that the use of the cage match here. To me, though, even though Brock Lesnar seems as though he would be primed for victory in this match, because, again, much like WrestleMania, I don't see the benefit in having Triple H win, this doesn't mean that it makes it okay that Triple H won at WrestleMania. And that's just me, you know, talking personally, just because I would rather not see a third match anyway. So if they would have just had Brock beat him at the pay-per-view, we wouldn't have to go through this. It would be nice to have Brock Lesnar, let's say, move on to a feud with somebody else, like a Randy Orton, or a Sheamus, who I guess now is tied up with Mark Henry. But I'm begging to see a fresh opponent from Brock Lesnar. You know, you want to do the match with Rock next year, if that happens, fine. But you can't tell me that in the meantime, Brock can't have one or two feuds with guys that he's never wrestled before. So I can't say I'm all that enthusiastic about the prospects of a third Triple H Brock Lesnar match, but this segment, awesome stuff. Easily the best thing on the entire show Monday night. Kofi Kingston beat Antonio Cesaro for the United States Championship. I will say, first and foremost, this was a really good match, and I can never complain about there being a really good match on Raw. But Antonio Cesaro, I mean, what is there to say? This could actually turn out to be the best thing for his career. I really feel like there's nowhere else for him to go at this point but up. But my God, can somebody explain this to me? Because as far as I know, the guy is a model citizen. He is a model employee. He didn't piss anybody off. You know, he didn't bump into somebody backstage and spill coffee all over them or anything like that. He won the U.S. title in the fall of last year. He was booked very, very strong, lost very rarely, and all of a sudden one week he started losing. And he lost again, and he lost again, and he lost again. And then they saddled him with this yodeling gimmick, which is the absolute worst thing that you could do with this guy. This yodeling crap has got to die. They had him doing it again Monday night. Please, please stop with the yodeling. Okay, even Swiss Solomonster says enough is enough. Get rid of the yodeling. But he lost the United States Championship. He had the title for like 240 days or something like that. This was like the longest title reign behind CM Punk's 434-day reign. And it just ended in a random match against Kofi Kingston on Raw. But like I said, the more I think about this, as awful as he's been booked, and it's just been completely terrible for them to do this to him, because they had a good thing going with the guy. You know, he was booked really strong. They had him doing these strongman feats. He got Kali up for the neutralizer, all these big guys up for the neutralizer. They kept talking about how strong this guy is. And now they've torn him down, and they've got to build him back up again. And we've seen this time and time again. It's like they're hurting themselves by doing that. I don't understand the logic behind it. But I'm okay with this. I'm okay with this because that title, that United States Championship, is like the freaking Hope Diamond in terms of bad luck, okay? They say the Hope Diamond, you know, don't go near it, don't touch it, it brings you bad luck. Fuck the Hope Diamond, you know? Put the U.S. title in a museum and tell people to stay away from it and tell people about the bad luck that it brings. Now that that title is off him, it's almost like an albatross, like an anchor that was just tying him down. Maybe now they'll actually finally do something with this guy. You know, one thought I had, and it's just a random thought, not going to happen, but you've got Cassius Ohno down in developmental, and Cassius Ohno's name has been floated around quite a bit recently as one of the next people, perhaps, who might be called up to the main roster. Bray Wyatt, another name that's been bandied about. Adrian Neville would be another. Why not bring Cassius Ohno up to the roster? Start a little feud with him and Cesaro that somehow leads to the two of them teaming. If they don't have any plans for Antonio Cesaro in terms of his singles career, because really, what do you do with him now? You know, for him to wrestle for the U.S. title or the Intercontinental title is death. I would keep him as far away from those belts as humanly possible. So the only other thing that he could really do would be to compete for the WWE Championship or the World Heavyweight title. Well, he's not competing for the WWE Championship. And right now you've got Dolph Ziggler, a heel, as the World Heavyweight Champion, feuding with two people. So Cesaro is kind of stuck in purgatory right now. I would not mind them putting him in a tag team with Ono, because the two of them work tremendously well together. They were a very entertaining tag team in Ring of Honor. They were the kings of wrestling. They were fantastic. So why not put the two of them together? Right now, they need more tag teams. You've got Team Hell No, whose days are probably numbered. You have The Shield, which is, not really a tag team. It's three dudes, but still. You've got The Shield. You've got Team Hell No. You've got the Primetime Players, who keep losing. You've got the Usos, who they're never going to do anything with. Who else? I feel like I'm missing one more team. That's it. That's all they have. So why not add one more tag team and actually do something with Cesaro? And then when you're ready to do it, you break them up. And you let both guys go their separate ways. You don't have to worry about these two guys meshing and gelling. They've already got the built-in chemistry. Do it. Do it. It's something to do with him. Jack Swagger. He actually pinned Dolph Ziggler on this show with a roll-up. Dolph Ziggler was supposed to have a match with Alberto Del Rio. And Swagger came out, ruined those plans, and they made a match between Swagger and Dolph. Non-title, of course. So I'm watching this match. The crowd is dead. People could not care less. They could not possibly care any less about this match, and they already do. Dolph Ziggler is seemingly being built up as the babyface in this match. He's getting beaten down. He makes a comeback. And I'm sure Ziggler at some point will go babyface, but that he didn't here. And at one point, Swagger drapes him over the top rope for a hangman, and then he just rolls him up and pins him 1-2-3. Just like that, in the middle of the ring. Now, I get why they did it. They want to keep Jack Swagger in the title picture. It's probably going to be a triple threat match at Extreme Rules. It will be Ziggler defending the championship against Swagger and Del Rio. But 1 week after that epic title win on Raw, this was his first match on Raw since becoming the World Heavyweight Champion. And you have Dolph Ziggler lose to Jack Swagger out of nowhere, with a roll-up in the middle of the match. Now, I'm not against having these kind of surprise finishes. It kind of makes wrestling seem a little more realistic in that you don't know when the match might end. Not everybody has to win every single match with their finishing hold. I'm not against that. But for Dolph to lose that way 1 week after winning the World Heavyweight title, the first thought that popped in my head was Rey Mysterio. If you remember when Rey Mysterio won the World Heavyweight title in 2006... What a title run Rey Mysterio had. He lost to everybody, every single week. He lost to Kali. Every week they beat him like a drum. And that's the first thought that popped in my head this week when I saw Ziggler lose that match the way he did. It's just amazing. It's just amazing to me. CM Punk came out with Paul Heyman. He didn't say very much. The crowd was more alive probably for Punk in this one segment than they were for almost anything else on the entire show. And Punk just looked around, he hugged Heyman, and he walked away. So we are led to believe that CM Punk is perhaps gone forever. And the plan had been for Punk to take some time off, perhaps up to 3 or 4 months. It sounds like he won't be gone for that long. I would not expect him to be on Raw, for example, the next 2 or 3 weeks. But it's entirely possible that CM Punk could be back on television in May. I don't know that he would wrestle at Extreme Rules, but apparently he's on the pay-per-view posters for all the shows after that, so I don't think CM Punk is going to be gone for quite as long as people thought he might be gone for, but for at least the next few weeks, it looks as though we will have to deal without CM Punk. He's healing up from some injuries. He got banged up quite a bit at WrestleMania, and it makes sense to me for Punk to walk away and take some time off, not just to heal up any nagging injuries, but I have no idea who he feuds with next. There is no logical next opponent for CM Punk. Who would that be? Let's look at the roster right now. Now, I don't have the roster in front of me, so maybe I'm missing people, okay? Let's look at Raw. John Cena is the top babyface. John Cena is not feuding with CM Punk, at least not before Extreme Rules, okay? It's Cena-Ryback. That's the feud. And he's a heel, okay? So I suppose they could bring Punk back as a babyface. I think that would be a mistake. Because I think he's so goddamn great as a heel, and I'm still holding out hope for that match with Steve Austin at WrestleMania next year. The off chance, the small, slight chance that may exist of that match happening, it really needs to be Austin against the heel Punk. So to turn Punk babyface and then, let's say, turn him heel, again next year out of nowhere would seem kind of dumb to me. Being the villain is the perfect role right now for CM Punk. I wouldn't turn him. you just don't have that many options. Unless you put Punk with Sheamus. Sheamus is occupied right now with Mark Henry. You could feud him with Randy Orton, I suppose, although that's not a feud that really holds any interest for me, and there's a lot of talk that Orton's going heel soon. Everybody seems to be going heel soon. I'm sure somebody is. I just don't know who they're going to pull the trigger on. And somebody like a Kofi Kingston or an R-Truth is below CM Punk's level. You know, that's not a feud that lights my world on fire. Before, I would have said Kingston would have made a nice opponent 1 month for Punk during his title reign, but those days are done. You know, Kofi now has the U.S. title. Punk's not the champion anymore. I don't see what you accomplish by doing that. There's no obvious opponent for the guy, so just let him take some time off. Let him heal up, and when you have a good idea for him, you bring him back. I would love to see them do something where, you know, we've never seen Punk and Lesnar together as a team or in any capacity. It's not like Paul Heyman came out on Raw 1 week and he had both Punk and Brock with him. You could do a lot of things if you want to have a full-on Heyman faction, in a way where you see both guys on television in the ring at the same time as Paul Heyman, you know, cuts a promo. Have a pay-per-view. You know, look, I would have loved to have seen a pay-per-view match where CM Punk teams up with Brock Lesnar against Triple H and The Undertaker. I almost would have preferred that over the Triple H Lesnar singles match at WrestleMania. So I suppose they could go in that direction also. Although, again, Lesnar wouldn't be an opponent for Punk, so I don't know still who Punk's opponent would be. And Lesnar isn't even available for that many dates, so how much can you really do with him on television if the guy is only going to make one appearance a month or two appearances per month on TV? How much can you really do? So let Punk have his time off, and when he's good and ready, he'll be back in action. Speaking of R-Truth, he beat Wade Barrett to become the number one contender, seemingly, for the Intercontinental Championship. Again, he beat Wade out of nowhere, very similar to how Swagger beat Dolph on this show. It looked... Now, I've gone back and watched this match again because people said Truth won with his move. At first, I didn't even realize that he had used his move. It just seemed like he gave him like a DDT or something like that, and then he just pinned him out of nowhere. But apparently he used his move, but still, the finish was very sudden. Just a bad night, yet again, to be a secondary champion in WWE. Between the way Cesaro's been treated, then he lost his title, Barrett now losing to R-Truth. Wow. You know, again, I would hate to be the Intercontinental Champion or the U.S. Champion right now. That's all I have to say about that. Then we had Fandango. Fandango was in the ring for a segment with Jerry the King Lawler. And before Fandango came out, Lawler actually said on commentary, he said, "Will the crowd Fandango? Will the crowd be Fandangoing next when we come back?" They built this thing up like this guy was the biggest star on the roster. They showed footage of the Fandangoing sensation going viral, news people, you know, doing the Fandango on their show, and, you know, look, I'm not saying that it's wrong of them to show footage like that. I'm actually okay if they wanted to show some clips, but they built this whole thing up like as soon as this guy was going to walk out, you'd have the whole crowd standing up, pointing in the air, singing the song, and they did not do that on this show. I knew they weren't going to do it because this crowd was dead from the moment this show started. This was not the crowd to expect that kind of reaction from. They haven't been going crazy for anything on this show up until this point. But there's Lawler in the ring. He's talking about Fandango. Here he comes. And the crowd did not care. Now, it was funny to me. It was actually quite hilarious watching Kevin Dunn and the WWE production people pan the crowd, showing people who were dancing. There were pockets of people who were doing the dance. But you'll notice there were no wide crowd shots like we had the night before. The week before in Jersey, they had these wide crowd shots of everybody in the building doing the Fandango dance. And here this week, they had very close cropped camera angles of like two people doing the dance. And you could see everybody around them just standing there like they just did not give a shit about what was going on. This was an embarrassment. This segment was a complete and total embarrassment. You know, I said before the segment even came back, when they came back from commercial and Fandango came out, I said, they're going to kill it. It has to be organic. Don't force it. Don't force it. People don't like it when you force shit down their throats. Exhibit A, John Cena. People resent you for it. And when WWE starts to promote it and push it, it just becomes uncool. So in 1 week, WWE managed to make the Fandango craze uncool. There's a lot of people who thought probably it was never cool in the first place. But for those who think that it was cool, 1 week. It took them 1 week to nearly destroy this thing. And I say nearly because I'm pretty sure that Fandango's going to come out on Raw in the UK this week. He's going to get the reaction they were hoping he would get last week. And the real test is going to be the week after that and the week after that, whenever they come back to the States. Because, again, it may be the next 2 weeks overseas of television that they're doing. Whenever their next U.S. date for Raw is, that's going to be the real test of the staying power, I guess, of this Fandango garbage. And we're going to know for sure exactly whether or not the guy is really over or if the music was over for 2 weeks and that was it. I tend to be on the side of the music was really over for 2 weeks and that's it. We'll see. But this segment, it made me cringe. They were trying so hard to get people to do the dance and to sing the song and to make it seem like this guy was a big deal. Fandango is not a big deal. I said it last week. I stay true to my belief here. The match with Jericho at WrestleMania was okay. Maybe even good. But it wasn't like a blowaway match. He didn't have the match that I felt he needed to have. And I'm still not impressed by Fandango. Now, maybe in the long run, I will be. Steve Austin went on Twitter last week and said that he predicts in 6 to 8 months Fandango is going to be the Intercontinental Champion. I hope to God that doesn't happen for his sake, because you got to keep that guy away from the Intercontinental title if you want to get him over. I don't think Austin quite comprehends how much the Intercontinental title that he once held has fallen in terms of value and prestige. Fandango himself is not over. The music is over. Now, maybe I'm wrong. I don't think I am. This segment was an embarrassment. We had a Divas match on this show. It was one of the Bella Twins against Caitlyn. At least I think that's the match. I could be wrong about that because I fell asleep and missed the first half of this match. So unfortunately, no Divas stopwatch. Apparently the match went about 5 minutes or so, which is actually pretty long by Divas standards. Even though the announcer spent the entire length of the match talking about... Apparently Jerry Lawler made a comment about how one Bella is bigger than the other, and, you know, they were kind of ribbing him because, you know, the implication there is that one Bella is fat and the other one is not. That's not what he meant. What he meant was one has basically a bigger rack than the other one, because I think Nikki had breast augmentation surgery that Brie did not have. In my opinion, Brie is the better-looking Bella twin. That's Daniel Bryan's twin, for those of you keeping track of these things. I think John Cena is still dating Nikki. I have no idea. But anyway, that's what Lawler meant, but Lawler couldn't come out and say that because, you know, it's a PG show. So that's all they spent time talking about during this match. They didn't talk about the match itself at all. So that was the big Divas match this week. And the other thing that struck me was the fact that they booked the same finish, basically, on the same show with the Ziggler Swagger match as they did here in the Divas match, right down to the champion losing. This is a bad night to be a champion in WWE. You had Cesaro losing his U.S. title. You had Wade Barrett losing clean to R-Truth, and Caitlyn here losing to one of the Bellas. And the same exact finish, too. I think she got draped over the rope and then rolled up. How do you have the same finish like that on the same show within only a few segments? That was kind of dumb. It was also a very interesting production snafu in the main event. John Cena came out to confront Ryback, and at one point they actually cut to a camera somewhere elsewhere in the arena where we saw the Shield. And at that point we pretty much knew the Shield's coming out for this segment, which I figured they were anyway. I knew exactly what they were going to do here before they even did it, with, you know, Ryback earlier talking about how, you know, you never saved me when the Shield would attack me. I knew exactly what they were going to do here. But that was, at first I thought maybe it was part of what they had planned, but apparently not. They just cut to the Shield when they weren't supposed to, and the announcers at that point, I guess Vince was in their ear saying you may as well just acknowledge it, which the announcers did. So I thought that was kind of amusing. But that was the end result here, you know. Basically, Cena stood up to Ryback. Ryback did what every heel does. He backed down. He turned away. He left the ring. And that's when the Shield's music hit. They came out. They attacked Cena. Ryback stood there and watched, walked away. And that was it. That was Raw from Monday night. The crowd in Greenville almost redeemed itself by chanting one more time at the end of the show. And again, what does that say about John Cena as your top babyface when we all know the reaction he gets every single week, but you have this crowd that was alive for very few things on this show. But the one thing they came alive for at the end was cheering for the further destruction of the biggest babyface on the roster. They wanted the Shield to powerbomb John Cena one more time. Wow. Big match sign for Raw next week, this Monday in the UK. Six-man tag, it's going to be The Shield against Daniel Bryan, Kane, and The Undertaker. Undertaker was already set to appear on the SmackDown taping. I guess they were struggling in terms of selling tickets, so they added him to the show. And I guess because he's going to be over there anyway, they figured, well, let's do something with him on Raw. So The Undertaker will actually be wrestling on Raw this Monday night, a rarity. This could be the last time that we ever see The Undertaker wrestle on Raw. So this is actually a big deal. And to me, anyway, this is a big match. I don't even know if this will be the main event. I could see them using this as your co-main event for the top of the 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock hour. I don't know if this will be the final segment on the show, but it should be, because this is a big attraction. You know, whenever you have The Undertaker wrestling at all these days, it's a major attraction. And I'm looking forward to that match. And again, really cool to see Daniel Bryan involved in that. You know, for him to be in the middle of you know, Undertaker, literally in the middle of Undertaker and Kane, is a pretty good spot for him to be in. So, The Shield, what can I say about them? Every time they're in their six-man tag team match, they usually do a hell of a job, and we've seen them. They were in the same match with Kane and Daniel Bryan at that TLC pay-per-view in December, only it was Ryback with them and not The Undertaker. Again, if this match is anything like that match in December, this is going to be a hell of a match on Monday night coming up, so I'm looking forward to that. But as far as this show from this past Monday, not a big fan. Speaking of not a big fan, that brings me to Impact. What a boring show on Thursday night. Impact Wrestling, this was the second taping from Corpus Christi, and this is going to be a problem, I think, for them going forward, because you have a situation where, under normal circumstances, the first taping, you probably have a pretty lively crowd. I don't remember the crowd actually being all that lively in Corpus Christi last week, but they were livelier than they were this past Thursday. This crowd, again, was dead. And this goes to show you, you look at that crowd in Jersey after WrestleMania, and you look at Raw from this past Monday, you look at Impact, the crowd can make a very big difference in people's perception of a show. They may perceive this show to be boring and just not very good just because the people that are in the building are not reacting to it. And so we had this crowd on Thursday that did, they were probably tired. They were already there for one taping. They taped two shows in one night. And so for these second tapings that they do going forward, I think this may be the sort of crowd reaction you see because they're just burned out from the first taping. We had Wes Briscoe and Garrett Bischoff from Aces and Eights against Kurt Angle in a handicap match. And Briscoe and Bischoff beat Kurt in this match. They used a chain. The referee was distracted by Ken Anderson, who ran out. They hit Angle with a chain, and they pinned him. Now, I mention this because later on in the show, we had D-Von in a television title match against Samoa Joe. He was supposed to be D-Von and Magnus. And Magnus got beat up by the Aces and Eights. He got laid out, as Joseph Park did as well in a segment later in the shower. That sounded weird, but yes, he did get beat up in a shower. So D-Von faced Samoa Joe instead, Magnus' former tag team partner. And Ken Anderson ran in with Brass Knucks. Garrett Bischoff came out again with Wes Briscoe. They distracted referee Earl Hebner. And D-Von used the Knucks, or maybe Anderson did, I don't know. The Knucks got used on Joe, and D-Von pinned him. That was the match that really pissed me off. And the reason it pissed me off is this, okay? I accept that in pro wrestling, the referees are pretty much dumber than dirt. We all accept that, right? Referee gets distracted very easily. He doesn't see the interference, or he gets bumped slightly, and he, you know, he takes a fall, and he's touching his eye like he got something in his eye. The referees in pro wrestling are pretty fucking dumb. But what we saw here was just completely ridiculous. First of all, we saw the same finish in the first match on the show, okay, when Briscoe and Bischoff beat Kurt. Hit him with a chain, referee didn't see it. But at least in that match, you could tell, okay, the referee really didn't see it. In this match, anybody watching with two functioning eyeballs can see that Earl Hebner saw exactly what happened. At least make the fucking attempt to make it seem like you did not see what just happened. Turn your body a little bit more. No, there's Hebner looking, basically, at what just happened, and he just counts the fall, 1, 2, 3, match over. I mean, how difficult is it to just pretend that you did not see what just happened? Don't look in the direction of what's going on. Wait for your cue from the guy who's distracting you, okay? When the guy gets hit with Knucks, that person will tell you, turn around. I don't know why. It really irritated me. And we see this shit all the time. It shouldn't really bother me. But for whatever reason, it really got on my nerves. It's like they don't care. They're so goddamn lazy. Make it look like you don't see what's going on. Pretend. Put a little bit of effort into it. So this was just dumb. It was the same finish twice. I don't know. It was an entire show filled with Aces and Ace just beating people up. It was so fucking boring. This whole show was just Aces and Eights beating up this guy. Aces and Eights beating up that guy. Hit this guy with this weapon. Hit this guy with that weapon. And by the end of the show, I'll skip ahead to the end of the show here because it doesn't even matter. We had, it was AJ Styles. Okay, AJ Styles had his first match on television in months. And he beat James Storm with some submission hold. I think it might be a new move he's using. After the match, AJ attacked Chris Daniels and Kazarian. After teasing that he might just join with them, he beat them up. Aces and Eights came back out. They attacked Storm. Styles just walked away. He basically pulled a Ryback after what Ryback did to Cena on Monday. And Bully Ray came out, and he cut a promo saying that next week on Impact, he is going to call out Hulk Hogan. Great. Can't wait. I'm so sick of the Aces and Eights garbage. Complete overkill on this show. And the prospect of Bully coming out to challenge Hulk Hogan, sorry, doesn't really excite me. I don't understand where they're going with this in terms of involving Hogan as much as they are, because Hogan cannot be wrestling a match. That just cannot be the end result of this. I could see them bringing Sting back at Slammiversary for a title match with Bully. I could see them building to AJ Styles beating Bully for the championship at Bound for Glory. Does everything really have to be about Hulk Hogan? Is that really necessary? But on this one show, they took the Aces and Eights stuff way too far. Complete overkill. You know, I really did think that Bully being added to the Aces and Eights, and that first week, I thought to myself, you know what? Maybe they've turned a corner here. The Aces and Eights stuff wasn't bad. Bully brought a certain fire and passion to the group that they just did not have before, a certain personality. And it's only been a few weeks now, and I'm right back to where I was before. I could give a shit about Aces and Eights. I am so sick to death of this Aces and Eights crap. And I don't even think that Bully can save it at this point. Just completely, horrendously overbooked garbage with the Aces and Eights on this show. We had Kenny King beating Zema Ion and Petey Williams in a Triple Threat X Division match to retain his championship. The match was littered with boring chants, which I don't get. I thought the match was actually really good. So, you know, fuck the fans chanting boring during this match. They also tried out this new referee headcam, which I would rather not see the headcam make a return again. You know, look, they tried something different. I can't fault them for it. They actually did this gimmick in WCW many years ago, and there's a reason why WCW gave it up. It just doesn't work. It's just unnecessary. So hopefully they get rid of the referee headcam, but for 1 week they tried it. Fine. Didn't work. Bad Influence had a segment with Bobby Roode and Austin Aries. You heard a little bit of the audio at the beginning of the Sound Off. Pretty entertaining stuff between the two of them. Next week on Impact, it's going to be a Tag Team Championship rematch yet again. Bobby Roode and Austin Aries against Chavo and Hernandez. If they know what's good for them, they'll take the titles off Chavo and Hernandez and break them up. I don't think anybody would care. And Aries and Roode can be back to being the Tag Team Champions, and maybe they can finally get that feud with Bad Influence that I think a lot of people have been waiting for, myself included. That was basically Impact on Thursday. The story of the show, too much Aces and Eights. Tone down the Aces and Eights. And please, for the love of God, don't build everything around Hulk Hogan, okay? Just, I beg of you. Have them feud with somebody else. Bring back Sting! I mean, Sting is not all that much better. He's 54 years old, but my God, at least Sting can do stuff physically. You know, he can, I don't know. You know, I have to, before I move on here, I should mention one other thing. When Kurt Angle got his ass kicked by Bischoff and Briscoe at the beginning of the show, I tweeted about this. Does nobody give a shit about Kurt Angle in the back? How many times have we seen attacks on babyfaces by Aces and Eights? And Hulk Hogan and everybody else, they even had, on this show, they had backstage segments with heels, with Bobby Roode and people like that. Kenny King talking about how awful it is that Aces and Eights has taken over, nobody feels safe and all this. Why is it then that when Magnus or Kurt Angle or Samoa Joe or anybody gets beat up and gang raped basically by the Aces and Eights in the middle of the ring, or beat up in the back that nobody comes to their rescue? I would hate to work as a worker on the TNA roster. Talk about an unsafe working environment. Talk about a roster full of sharks out to look out for nobody but themselves. You would think somebody would come out and rescue these guys. Nope, nobody lifted a finger. Kurt Angle got his ass beat, and nobody did anything to save him. Magnus got chokeslammed on the stage, on the ramp. And then after he had been assaulted, Samoa Joe finally came out. By the way, Samoa Joe wore a t-shirt on this show. So it's finally, Samoa Joe realized that if he's going to wrestle, he should probably wear a t-shirt at this point. It's basically come to that. Don West, the great Don West, who no longer is with TNA, he left last year to take a position with a minor league sports team. I think it was a hockey team. Anyway, Don West tweeted something interesting this week. He said, "Just got my biannual royalty check from TNA, and if it wasn't so hilarious, it would be sad." And somebody tweeted to him. They said, "Was it in a brown bag special?" Brown bag specials were these things that Don West used to do. He would say he's such a great salesman and a great pitch man. He would have these brown bag specials where you would go to a TNA event. He would say, "All right, I'll tell you what I'm going to do for you guys. I'm going to put, you know, this in the brown bag. You get a DVD and an action figure and a t-shirt and this and that, and it's only, you know, whatever the price would be." That's what the brown bag special was. So somebody tweeted at him and said, "Was it in a brown bag special?" And Don West said, "It actually is less than a brown bag special." So I can only imagine what this royalty check that he got from TNA must have looked like. I felt bad for the guy, you know, because he never came off as being bitter or anything. He was always the consummate, you know, cheerleader for TNA and the consummate professional, and I've never heard him really utter a bad word about the company. And I wouldn't say he was necessarily bashing the company here, but the fact that he would take to a public forum like Twitter and say something like that, I think speaks volumes. I want to take a few minutes and talk about one of the newer WWE releases. It actually came out early last month, but I only recently got to finally finish it, and that is the Bret Hitman Hart Dungeon Collection DVD set, comprised entirely of Bret Hart matches that have never before been released on DVD, which is a rare thing because a lot of times WWE will put out multiple DVD releases for people. You know, Mick Foley, for example, has another DVD, For All Mankind, which from reviews I've heard already is really, really good, and hopefully that'll be the next one I'm able to tackle. But a lot of times you'll have matches that appear on multiple DVDs, and it kind of makes you go, well, what are you paying for? You know, I already have that match. Well, with this DVD set, you don't really have that problem, because none of these matches have been released by WWE in the past, and in a lot of cases, these are Bret Hart matches that I myself have never seen before, and in other cases, they're matches that I have seen before, but just not for a very long time. What I liked about this DVD a lot, and I hope they do more of this in future releases, this is not a straight biographical look at Bret Hart's career. If you want that, there's been at least one, if not two, Bret Hart DVDs. There was, of course, the first one they did with him back in 06, I want to say. And then there was a Hart Family DVD that had more stuff on Bret. You can watch those releases and get a very good flavor for his career and some of the other more popular matches that he's had over the years. This is not, you know, a two-hour documentary look at the life and times of Bret Hart. So if you're looking for that, you're looking in the wrong place. This is Bret Hart sitting down and talking at depth, in depth, I should say, about various matches and feuds that he has had with specific superstars over the years. And it starts from his early days. They have matches that are on this DVD set that date all the way back to his days in Stampede Wrestling, Georgia Championship Wrestling, and, of course, his early days in WWF back then. There's a match on there where it's the Hart Foundation against the Islanders from the Philly Spectrum back in 1987, which is actually a really good match. There's also, even before that, a match with Dynamite Kid at the Capitol Center back in 1985. And Bret talks about the Dynamite Kid. So the way it works is it'll say, for example, Bret Hart on, and then it'll say Dynamite Kid, it'll say, you know, Diesel, Andre the Giant, Mr. Perfect. And Bret gives his thoughts on each one of those talents, each one of those performers, and what it was like to work with them. Or in some cases, you know, as with Booker T, which comes later on in the set, he wishes he had more of an opportunity to work with them than he did. Maybe he only had one or two matches with that person and never actually got to work a program with them. So Bret talks at length about these various things. And one of the other interesting aspects of this DVD, and I think you're starting to see more of this with DVD releases, from WWE. We saw this certainly with the CM Punk disc that they put out a few months ago. They're more open to using kind of wrestling insider lingo. So you'll have Bret Hart sitting there talking about what it was like to be a heel and what it was like to be a babyface and using, you know, vocabulary that we are not accustomed to seeing on a WWE release. So it always, it kind of makes me laugh now. You know, you'll have somebody like CM Punk, for example, who apparently hates it when fans use terms like heel and face and work and shoot and stuff like that, because you're not in the business, you don't know what you're talking about, you come off sounding like a mark. But yet you have these wrestlers who are constantly using these terms. Now they're putting DVDs out, including on Punk's own DVD, I think, where they use these terms. It's out there now. You know, the curtain has been pulled back. I mean, hell, the curtain got ripped off the goddamn shower rings a long time ago. So it's kind of funny to put that back on the fans, and the fans are idiots, and the fans are marks and smarks and all this stuff, when these guys are using these terms now in a public open forum. So, you know, get over yourself. But anyway, back to the Bret DVD. So Bret is sitting there, you know, he's talking about what it was like to work as, like, you know, a hero and a villain, a heel and a face and all that kind of stuff. And it's just, it's still unique for me to see that from WWE, from a release that they themselves put out. So to me, that was a refreshing change of pace. But again, some of the other matches that you find on here that are actually really, really good, you have matches with Kurt Hennig. There's a match between the two of them from 1989, and Bret talks at length about what it was like to work with Kurt and how their very first match, people in the back, other wrestlers, they knew that these guys could go. And they were actually looking forward to seeing Bret and Kurt go out there and have a, you know, tear the house down, have a kick-ass match. There were guys watching from the curtain. And apparently Bret and Hennig went out there and they stunk out the joint. They had just a terrible match. Everything was mistimed. They were bumping into each other and colliding with one another, and it was just an awful match. So they came back the next night, I think it was. And I think this might be the match that they show on the DVD. This was from the Maple Leaf Gardens in 1989. They did the same exact match, Bret said, okay? Move for move, hold for hold, very few, if any, changes or adjustments. They went out there and had the same match that stunk out the joint the week before, the night before, and they had a great match. It really is a very, very good match. There's a match on here between Bret Hart and Andre the Giant, a rare gem from Milan, Italy, back in 1989. Bret tells about what it was like to work with Andre and how Andre, it was a great honor to him because Andre, he found out afterwards, had personally gone to the agents and requested to work with Bret at that show. Perhaps because he wanted to have the best match he could possibly have. You know, Andre, in the state that he was in at that point in 89, he wasn't exactly going out there when he was programmed, for example, with the Ultimate Warrior and having great, awesome wrestling matches. So perhaps he just wanted to go out there, and he knew Bret could work, and Bret could probably sell really well for him. The match itself, you know, wasn't anything special, but it's just such a unique thing because this footage, you can actually find footage of this match on YouTube. Okay, so if you want to see Bret vs. Andre and you don't want to buy the DVD, I mean, I would recommend buying it, but you can find this match on YouTube. It's the only quality that's available, and WWE took that match and they put it on here, which, again, is something WWE is not accustomed to doing. You know, they have to have the best-looking footage, they have to kind of digitize everything and make it look great, and I appreciate that, but I also appreciate the fact that they didn't omit this match just because the quality of it really isn't that good. You can tell Bret Hart's input into this DVD set because he chose the matches. You know, he went through the archives, he picked out the matches that he wanted to be on here, and this was one of them. And I will say the first half or so of this match is awful quality. There's tracking issues with the footage. It's like a really bad, you know, it's like a video that you probably had back in the day recorded on a VHS cassette that you maybe watched a million times. And when you would watch one of those VHS tapes a million times, it had the tracking lines and it looked really bad. But then halfway through, for whatever reason, the quality improves. So the quality actually isn't that bad at the end. But it's still a match I had never seen before. It might have been the only match, I think, that he and Andre ever had. And it's just really, really surreal to see the two of them in the ring together. And back then, Bret was still part of a tag team. He had not yet started his ascension as a singles wrestler. You know, he was still one half of the Hart Foundation. And there he is in the ring with Andre the Giant. So you could tell that they knew, you know, they had big plans for Bret going forward at some point as a single star. Other matches that are on here. Another match I had never seen before that actually was a hell of a lot better than I thought it would be. It's a tag team match pitting the Hart Foundation against Big Boss Man and Akeem, the African Dream, the Twin Towers, back in 89. at a Superstars taping, I believe it was, in Duluth, Minnesota. Not a bad match at all. Maybe the best tag team match I've ever seen the Twin Towers have, quite frankly. That's on here. They have a match from Japan with Bret Hart and Tiger Mask, and Bret talks about how it was actually kind of disappointing. He was hoping to go in there and have the best match of his career, and it wasn't the best match of his career. I don't think it was a bad match, but just not up to what his expectations would have been for a match like that. So there's that. You know, that match is on there. Another really great match, Intercontinental Championship match between Bret Hart and Ric Flair from 1991. This was only about 2 months after Flair came over to WWF. This was a great match. It was every Ric Flair match you've ever seen, but these two worked really well together. I know Bret has talked about thinking that his Saskatoon match in 92 with Flair when he won the championship for the first time wasn't a good match. I've always disagreed with him on that. I think that's a very good match. I just think he's being hard on himself and probably doesn't think very much of Ric Flair as a wrestler. You know, the two of them have had their issues before. But this IC title match on here is really good stuff. They have a Bret Hart Undertaker match from Madison Square Garden back in 92, and Bret talks about how he actually misses that Undertaker. He misses that version of the Undertaker character, the one where really all he used to do was, you know, he wouldn't sell, he would choke people, he would get knocked down, he would raise up. Kind of surprised me to hear Bret say that. You would think Bret would be more amenable to the Undertaker character, for example, that he wrestled in 1997. At least at that point, Undertaker was more of a legitimate wrestler than he was in 92, but Bret actually says he kind of misses that old Undertaker character, and he said Undertaker went to him before the match and said, I want to go out there and have a great match. I look forward to working with you. There were certain stories, I will say, that Bret tells in terms of the build-up to some of these matches and the conversations he had with some of these guys that make me wonder if he's not editorializing and exaggerating a little bit. I have no way of proving that, but I got a little bit of the Hogan or Cena sense from Bret during certain points of this DVD, but still, that match is on there. There's a match with Bret and Bam Bam Bigelow from Milan, Italy in 1993, also very good. You know, even though I think their King of the Ring finals match in 93 was better, but Bret and Diesel had a match at the King of the Ring in 1994, which is a match I haven't seen in years and years, and kind of surprising that that match has not been on a previous DVD release, but I guess it hasn't. Bret talked about working with Kevin Nash, what that was like. They have a match between Bret and Owen Hart. Obviously, they had a whole bunch of matches. This is one that I don't remember. It was a no-holds-barred match from Raw in March of 1995. It might have actually been the week before WrestleMania 11, because they were talking about Bret's upcoming I Quit match with Bob Backlund. Really good match between Bret and Owen, should be no surprise. Bret talked about his feud with Jean-Pierre Lafitte, the evil pirate from... It was one of those wonderful gimmicks that WWF bestowed upon us, the fans, back in 1995. Perhaps the single worst creative year for the company ever. I put the word creative in there because there were actually some really good matches in that company in 95, and they had some really good workers. But creatively speaking, it was a creatively bankrupt year for the company. But Pierre, who used to be part of the Quebecers tag team, was actually a hell of an athlete. And Bret talked about what a pleasure it was working with him. They had some really great matches. But Bret completely ragged on his feud with Pierre Lafitte, because if you remember from that time, and I don't blame you if you blocked it out of your memory, their whole feud back then in 95 was based on Pierre stealing Bret's jacket. He stole his jacket. And Bret wanted his jacket back, and Bret talks about how completely absurd and ridiculous this thing was, because I could just go get another jacket made. Which, of course, is probably what everybody else was thinking at the time. I guess maybe they could have built it up where Bret could have said, well, you know, it has sentimental value to me, it was given to me by a dead relative or something. They never even bothered to do that. And it's just funny hearing Bret basically say the same thing that probably a lot of fans were thinking at that time. The match with Pierre is from the In Your House pay-per-view in 95. Really good match. Bret and Stone Cold Steve Austin in what I believe may have been the first ever Bret Hart-Steve Austin match. Bret was out of action at this point in 96. He was still on his little sabbatical. But he would wrestle on some of the international tours, you know, to fulfill those commitments for the company. So this was at an event in, I think this was in Kuwait, actually. And it was a really good match. A little slow. Not the best Bret Austin match I've ever seen. But that's on here. There is a WWF Championship match between Bret Hart and the Patriot from the In Your House Ground Ground Games. Ground Zero. I'm now melding the Mind Games and Ground Zero pay-per-view names together. September of 1997, Bret versus Patriot for the title. I saw this match on there and I'm like, oh God, the Patriot. Del Wilkes, this is going to be a freaking boring-ass match. And in fact, it was actually a very good match. Probably the best Patriot match that he had in his entire brief run with the company back in 97. Really good stuff. This was during Bret's really kind of mean, vicious heel period. He beat Patriot, then he beat him up after the match in a pretty brutal assault, choked him out with the American flag. That wasn't even the main event on the show. Shawn Michaels was in the main event in a just a straight singles match with The Undertaker. And then they get into Bret's WCW days. They show his WCW U.S. Championship match on Nitro from 99 with Booker T. This is where Bret talks about what a pleasure it was to work with Booker and how he regrets that the two of them really only had, I think, two matches the entire time he was in WCW. He said he wanted to work with Booker, he wanted to really help put him over, and just didn't have an opportunity to do so. Interestingly enough, we see Chuck Norris sitting front row ringside for this match at Nitro. And I guess it's a situation more so, not where Chuck Norris came to see WCW Monday Nitro, but WCW Monday Nitro came to see Chuck Norris. Bad joke. I apologize. But that match is on there. That's a kick-ass match with a shitty finish. Bret cheats to win. He is the heel. I get it. But it was just a really dumb finish to what was otherwise a pretty good match. They also show the Bret Hart Sting match from the WCW Mayhem pay-per-view in 99. I think that was the same pay-per-view where Bret went on to beat Chris Benoit to become the WCW World Heavyweight Champion. And, the match was good. When it comes to Bret's WCW stuff, I can't get all that excited because WCW just completely botched up Bret Hart. They never really used him to his full potential. He didn't have as many great matches there as I think he could have had. I mean, given the level of talent that WCW had on their roster, there's no reason for Bret not to go out there, you know, every other week and have a kick-ass match. The match with Sting was all right. But to go back to Booker T for a second, Bret talks about, you know, wanting to do more with him and help put him over. You know, to me, what really put Booker T over was that Best of Seven series with Chris Benoit, and it's kind of a shame that in his Hall of Fame speech, he wasn't able to mention that for obvious reasons. I just the thought that I had just now, and thinking back to Booker's Hall of Fame speech, if there was one glaring omission in terms of people he could have thanked, it was certainly Benoit. But again, I get why he couldn't do it. And then the DVD wraps up at that point. That was pretty much all the matches that were on there. But I really, really like this disc. All three, in fact. It's a three-disc DVD set. The format, the structure, I really enjoyed it. I hope that they do more of these types of releases in the future. If you're a Bret Hart fan, you're going to love this. If you're not a Bret Hart fan, I would even urge you to get it even if you're not a Bret Hart fan, just because there's a lot of really quality matches on there, and the format is fantastic. I recommend it. Two thumbs up. Let's move on to the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. We've neglected the mailbag here. Over the last few weeks, a lot of other stuff. We did the WrestleMania show, obviously, so just haven't had time for it. So let's get to business here. Lewis, listener of the show since episode 3 or 4, he can't remember exactly. This is my first time writing into the show. Want to congratulate you on the incredible job you do every week, and also wanted to know if I could get a birthday shout-out. I turned 32 back on April 9th. Actually, I would rather give a shout-out to my beautiful girlfriend, Erica, because she not only supports my wrestling addiction, but supports me in life. So I guess that shout-out is officially for Erica. I hope Erica is listening. Steve from New Jersey. Hey, Solomonster. Was hoping to get a shout-out for my birthday on April 22nd. The Friday before WrestleMania, I was lucky to see PWS Supercard Night 2, where New Jack had his final match against Necro Butcher. There was blood, staple guns, and light tubes involved, and New Jack won. He cut a pretty cool promo after the match. Well, I'm happy you enjoyed it. I can't say that staple guns and light tubes are my cup of tea, and I'm not the biggest New Jack fan, but if you had fun, that's all that matters. Kyle from upstate New York, first-time writer. I think your show is pretty stellar. I look forward to hearing it on Sundays when it comes out on iTunes. First heard about it from a clip on TV Tracks. Don't remember which clip it was, but it had to be good enough to make me subscribe to your show. Have a bunch of questions. We'll take two of them here. First, if Brock Lesnar never left after WrestleMania 20, do you think that Batista, John Cena, or JBL would have been as big and as popular as they ended up being? Personally, I don't think Batista would have been because WWE would have no need for another insanely muscular guy. Cena may have been popular, but I think he would still have the rapper gimmick. JBL would have never had the WWE title, but may have held the U.S. or Intercontinental title. What do you think? Well, there's no way to predict for sure. I mean, who's to say that whatever Brock Lesnar was going to do in the next year or two would have had anything to do with those three guys? I think Batista would have been a big star anyway. I think John Cena would not at all have the rapper gimmick. He would have evolved and probably would have still ended up being the guy that carried the company on his back. He would have been the man that they deemed the number one guy, because Brock Lesnar, quite frankly, was never going to be that guy. Brock Lesnar will not do the press and the sort of things that John Cena does. He just hates doing it. And, you know, even in WWE, back in the day when he was doing more of it, there's no way you can convince me that Brock Lesnar would have done all the shit that John Cena does. So Cena would have been fine. JBL's the interesting wild card here. JBL was the beneficiary, I think, of there just being a lack of depth on that side in terms of challengers at that time. And he's the one guy who I think if Brock would have stuck around, it could have impacted JBL's career. I agree. JBL first got that gimmick. That would have been right after WrestleMania when Lesnar left, if I remember correctly, if my timeline is accurate here, because JBL had that title match with Eddie Guerrero in May of 04. Then he won the title in June. That was right after Brock left. So I think JBL's the one guy who could have been negatively impacted by that. I don't know that JBL would have been the longest reigning champion in SmackDown history if Brock Lesnar were still around and had never gone to try his hand at football. But I think the other two would have been just fine. Second question, which new star in WWE from the 2004 to 2010 period had the most potential? For example, Chris Masters, Carlito, MVP, and guys like that. Of the crop that you mentioned, I think Carlito, easily, by leaps and bounds. You know, Chris Masters at that time got over because he was big and muscular. Now, later on, he slimmed down a little bit and became actually a pretty good wrestler. But at that time, Chris Masters, he was just a big jacked up dude. You know, if he had any potential, it was because of his look. I didn't see much more in him at that point. MVP's always been a talented guy. But Carlito, to me, I mean, Carlito won the U.S. title in his debut match. Obviously, they had plans for this guy. And the biggest reason why I think Carlito had so much potential and could have been a much bigger star, he was a Hispanic star. WWE now is desperate to find that next great Hispanic star, not named Rey Mysterio, because Rey's days in WWE are basically done. Sin Cara has been a bust. Alberto Del Rio, they're trying with him, but to me, it's not working. Del Rio is not at that level that Rey, for example, was at his peak when he was bringing in, you know, that Hispanic demo on SmackDown and all the Latin fans. Carlito could have been that guy. He had the look, he had the talent, and it just didn't work out. But Carlito, I think, out of that group, absolutely had the most potential. And like I said, they put a title on him in his first match. Obviously, they had big plans for him. Jonathan from the UK writes in, "Firstly, I want to say how brilliant your WrestleMania coverage was this year. I live in the UK, and it is therefore financially and practically difficult for me to attend a WrestleMania live, so your tweets and podcasts help me to share in the experience and greatly enhance my enjoyment of it." Well, thank you for that. "Do you think it would be a good idea to give young and upcoming tag teams gimmicks from the past? For example, a modern-day incarnation of the Road Warriors or Demolition. The gimmicks would, of course, be updated and revamped for a modern audience. Could this help get young talent over and inject some life into the tag team division while bringing classic characters to a new generation? Or is it best to just leave those gimmicks alone and leave their legacy in the past and come up with original ideas?" Never a bad idea to come up with original ideas. I don't like the idea of bringing back Demolition or Road Warriors. We've seen the Road Warriors brought back. You think back to SmackDown many years ago, Road Warrior Animal and Heidenreich. I know some people like that. I just thought it was, I never got into that at all, that modern day adaptation of the Road Warriors. To me, there's only one Road Warriors. Without Hawk, it just doesn't work. Demolition, to me, will always be Axe and Smash. Demolition would not work. What I would like are for WWE to come up with gimmicks or really cool tag team names like Demolition, like the Road Warriors. Think about it. The only real gimmick team name that we have right now is the Primetime Players. Right? They're a legitimate tag team. I know both guys were kind of doing their own thing before as a singles. You know, Titus O'Neil on NXT. Darren Young was also from NXT. But for all intents and purposes, they got their first big push as a tag team. They're the closest thing to an original tag team, I think, in WWE. I guess the Usos would be as well. But the Usos is not exactly a cool, intimidating tag team name. Team Hell No? Eh. I don't count that. So we don't really have teams like Demolition and the Road Warriors, the Destroyers, or, you know, not even gimmicks. I mean, it's more a matter of the team name and the team persona. I don't even know that gimmick is the right word for it. Maybe we need a team that walks out wearing spikes for shoulder pads and stuff like that. You know, whatever happened to that? Why does every team have to be team this or team that? You know, I think we do need more of that, but bringing back the same gimmicks from years ago is the wrong way to go. We need to come up with original ideas, figure out what tag teams do they have right now in NXT. They have the Wyatt family, I think, is one tag team that they have. And for the Wyatt family, I guess that's what you would call them because it works. But do they even have any other tag teams where they could put two guys together and give them a really cool tag team name? They have the Ascension, which kind of had that goth gimmick going for them, and then one of them fucked up and got fired. Poor Conor O'Brien now has to pay the price for it. But I don't really know what teams like that they have going right now. But yeah, I would love to see team names brought back like that. And you don't have to put the word team in front of it either. We don't need Team Hell No. We don't need Team Road Scholars. I know they're a fucking team. Drives me nuts. Anto from Birmingham, England, has been a fan since episode 217. The Sound Off and Rich Eisen's podcast are always downloaded every week. I was wondering if you knew of any storylines, matches, or people who were going to be pushed that never happened. This has always fascinated me, as it really is interesting finding out about things that could have happened in wrestling but didn't for reasons unannounced to the ordinary wrestling fan. Well, I mean, there's a couple of examples I could think of. I was trying to give this some thought before. One of the ones from WCW back in the day that jumps out at me. You know, originally the plan for Starrcade in 1993, which turned out to have this tremendous main event with Ric Flair and Vader. I mean, the way they built that match up, you know, that was Ric Flair. I think that was Ric Flair's first match back in a WCW ring. He had come back to WCW from WWF earlier in the year. But the way, you know, Vince McMahon let him out of his contract that he can go back, but he had to wait. There was still a period of time that he could not wrestle. So they had that Flair for the Gold talk show segment that he hosted and all that. But they built to this main event at Starrcade with Flair and Vader. It was so well built up, and the match was awesome. But that was not the original plan. The original plan was to have Sid Vicious beat Vader to become the WCW champion at Starrcade. And Sid ended up having the incident with Arn Anderson. We all know what happened there. With the scissors over in England. I think Sid got shit-canned after that. And Ric Flair, more or less, was kind of the backup plan. Hell of a backup plan, as things turned out. But yeah, that was supposed to be Sid beating Vader at Starrcade for the title, and I'm 99.999% sure that match would not have been nearly as good as what we ended up getting. There's Brakus in WWE. Remember Brakus? They would air these vignettes saying Brakus is coming, and he was this big, jacked-up, German-sounding dude, and he never did come. And eventually, he finally did. I think after the vignettes aired for months, just nothing happened. Then he actually did wrestle one match on Raw in 1998. I want to say it was against one of the Barriquas, but don't quote me on that. And that was it. Brakus just disappeared after that. So whatever plans they had for him, I guess, just evaporated for whatever reason. I think they sent him actually to ECW as well, but he never did go anywhere. There was 2001. Remember the two-man power trip with Triple H and Stone Cold Steve Austin? There was a plan in place for Triple H at one point to go face and feud with Austin for the championship. I believe that may have been the plan, actually. They were kind of starting to tease dissension. If you remember at that Judgment Day pay-per-view when Triple H lost the Intercontinental title to Kane, it was the next night on Raw that Austin and Triple H had that amazing tag team title match with Benoit and Jericho, which, again, is a damn shame that we'll never hear more about that match, or that match will be released on DVD because it was so goddamn awesome. But it was that night that Triple H had his quad torn in that match. I believe the plan was in place to at least start the slow build anyway to a breakup of the two-man power trip that would have led to Triple H challenging Austin for the championship, which obviously never happened. Triple H was gone for 8 months, came back as a babyface, but at that point Austin wasn't even the champion anymore, and they never really did anything with the two of them again after that. Kenzo Suzuki was another name I jotted down here. Kenzo Suzuki was brought in, I want to say 2003, 2004 is when he was brought into WWE. He had that female manager with him. At one point, the plan was to have Kenzo Suzuki challenge Chris Benoit. This was after Benoit won the World Heavyweight Championship. The plan for SummerSlam, I remember hearing at one point, was to build to a Kenzo Suzuki title match with Chris Benoit. That was going to be the Raw World Heavyweight Championship main event. And obviously, that did not happen. Kenzo Suzuki fizzled out. He was gone not long after. They ended up doing Orton and Benoit at SummerSlam, and Orton won the championship. So, yeah, wow. Imagine that. Suzuki and Benoit for the world title. What else? We have the Pirate. Paul and Katie Lee Burchill. They were going to do an incest storyline. I think many of you probably remember hearing that. Vince McMahon wanted to do an incest storyline because in storyline, they were brother and sister. And I guess Vince McMahon gets his rocks off on stuff like that. And it didn't happen. I don't know why it didn't happen. I don't know if he just changed his mind, if somebody talked him out of it, or if they realized they would run into perhaps some indecency issues with the product, because it wasn't, I don't think they were PG at that point. But the incest storyline, thankfully, never did happen. And you could also, you know, if you want to, I did a Layfield Report column a few weeks ago on the greatest WrestleMania matches that you never saw. There were a ton of WrestleMania matches that were talked about, that were planned, that were outright planned in some cases, and then for one reason or another, they never happened. One of the matches that I really am sad we never got to see, and this was never actually kind of the firm plan, but it was certainly talked about, was Shawn Michaels and Eddie Guerrero at WrestleMania 22. Seemed to be a direction that they were going in, that they were planning for, and obviously it never happened because Eddie died. So if you want to read more about stuff that never happened but could have, check out that Layfield column. Unfortunately, the columns are not archived the way they have it set up, so you can't just search by name. But if you look hard enough, you will find it. Maybe if you type it into Google or something, it'll come right up. But check that out. That's going to do it for the mailbag this week. So keep sending me your questions, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I'm trying to get all caught up on questions. There's been quite a backlog over the last 2 weeks, so I apologize. So keep emailing me. Also, follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. That is the official Twitter handle. You can follow me on there. We're picking up new people by the week. I appreciate that. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster is the official profile page for this show on Facebook, the one and only. We also have a fan page. If you type in Solomonster Sounds Off, which is the full name of the show, there is a separate Facebook fan page that I am hoping to post on more often, but if you would like that page, that would be awesome. That, again, is separate and apart from the actual profile page, but you can like us on Facebook if you want to. And subscribe in iTunes. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off. You can subscribe. It is free. It does not cost you anything. And every time a new episode is uploaded, you can download it. Actually, you don't even have to download it. It'll automatically download for you. And thank you to the few more people who left reviews in iTunes for this show. That helps us out a lot, so I appreciate that a great deal. And don't forget, you can also go to thesolomonster.com. That is the official website for the show, for yours truly. You can also make a PayPal donation to the show if you would like to. It's safe and secure. It's on the right-hand side. You scroll down just a little bit, there's a little box. You can type in whatever dollar amount, whatever currency, whatever country you may be in. You can make a donation to the show, and you'll get a personal thank you from me because I would very much appreciate that. So you can check that out as well. That's going to wrap up episode 270 this week on what was not the best of weeks. You know, I say it every week, be well, stay safe. It sounds kind of cliche, and unfortunately there were people who were around last week who are no longer with us, and that's just a real shame. So wherever you may be in the world, be well, stay safe, and we will see you right back here next week for episode 271 of The Solomonster Sounds Off, an SE Scoops original show. We'll see you right back here next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.